Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Is President Trump trying to change the subject from his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, or is he thinking about a war with Iran? That's the question today after President Trump tweeted last night to the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, "Never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before." That was after Rouhani said earlier in the day that America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace and war with Iran is the mother of all wars. Joining us now is Behnam Ben Talablu, who is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Good to have you. And first of all, let's go to the statement from President Rouhani. Why would he say what he said, that America must understand that war with Iran is the mother of all wars?
Well, Rouhani right now in Iran is at the heart of several campaigns. He's looking to work with Europe to save the JCPOA nuclear deal. And at the same time, his government and Iran is beginning to feel the economic and political pressure the Trump administration is levying. We know that the administration has increased the pace of Treasury Department designations against Iran since the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal on May 8th. And on August 6th and November 4th, heavy U.S. sanctions will be reinstated against Iran, and Iran is desperately looking for leverage here, both in the region and geopolitically against the U.S.
And does he feel that they get leverage, though, by saying what he's saying about the U.S.? Is that supposed to make it more likely that the sanctions will go away, or what?
It's a form of political warfare at its heart. In essence, Iranian leaders, when they expound this kind of inflammatory rhetoric, are looking to, at the strategic level, deter a conventional attack from ever happening on their soil. So Rouhani is fearing about the prospects of escalation, and he's looking to deter any kind of pushback against Iran in the region more generally, because he knows what could be a war with Iran in one conflict zone could spread to another. But again, this is also political signaling. This is grandstanding. This is expected. And I think we'll see more of this as the heavier sanctions are imposed and actually enforced.
So what do you make of President Trump's response?
I think it's the international global version of what we may see domestically, or the counterpunching phenomenon. I think President Trump doesn't want to let these kind of rebukes against the United States go unanswered. Twitter is an interesting medium. We know the president has successfully used the bully pulpit against Iran before, at least on several occasions. Once during the campaign trail, President Trump mentioned that if the IRGC Navy kept harassing the U.S. vessels in the Persian Gulf, he would blow them out of the water. Since the president came into office, the number of harassment attacks went down in 2017, and allegedly in 2018, that number is zero. The same with medium-range ballistic missile tests. We haven't had an Iranian ballistic missile test in over a year. That's quite odd, because from July 2015 to July 2017, there have been at least, 23 ballistic missile tests.
So is the president's strategy working then?
It works on selective occasions. It's up to the Iranians to interpret how this tweet will play out over time. Of course, tough rhetoric is good, but you have to have a policy to follow up on that tough rhetoric. And what you saw with at least the Pompeo speech the other day in Los Angeles at the Reagan Library is at least a plan to continue putting the spotlight on Iran's domestic human rights abuses, continue putting the regime officials in check, going after their assets. So I think that part of the strategy will work. It just needs a lot of follow through.
Well, you mentioned the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, speaking at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. We also heard this morning from Mark Lauder, who is the former special assistant to President Trump. He was on Morning Edition today, and here's what he said.
This is a very strong signal to the Iranian people that the United States and her allies have your back, that when they make the choice to change leadership, to rejoin the world community, they will be welcomed.
Is the U.S. overpromising to the Iranian people when it says, we'll have your back?
It really depends on how the Iranians interpret that. I mean, so far the Iranians seem buoyed by their rhetoric on Twitter and elsewhere by the administration, but they're also calling upon the administration to do more already. I think circa January, February, you saw tweets asking the administration to go after IRIB. This is Iran's state broadcaster. And for an administration which has pulled out of the Iran deal, it interestingly still has not gone after Iran's state broadcaster to revoke this waiver. I think that would be a very powerful, very helpful signal to let the Iranian people know over time yes, we not only stand with you, but we have your back, and here's what we're doing in XYZ political arena.
There are many people who will look at these tweets from President Trump and the statement from Pompeo and say this is a big effort to distract from all the negative coverage that the president got about his summit with Vladimir Putin last week. What do you think about that?
I would certainly hope it's not, but I think if you link the Helsinki summit and as well as the Singapore summit with the North Korean leadership, we're kind of dealing in this new world now, coercive diplomacy, engagement, negotiations, whatever you want to call it, with authoritarian leaders and rogue states. And I hope that, you know, we can marshal all elements of national power to deal with these kind of issues, whether it's economic, military, intelligence, diplomatic. The question is, of course, how much are these rogue states learning from different iterations? How much are the Koreans learning from the Russians? And how much are the Iranians learning from the Russians? And how much are the Iranians learning from the Koreans? Are they figuring out what it means to conduct diplomacy with this administration and with the U.S. in general? What playbooks are they sharing? And I hope that the administration is cognizant of this and looks to break these chains if they do exist.
That's Behnam Bentaleblou, who is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
When students across the country return to school this fall, there will not be enough teachers. The shortage is a nationwide problem, and it does not seem to be getting much better. The nonprofit Learning Policy Institute says the number of people studying to be teachers in the U.S. dropped 35% between 2009 and 2014. And hundreds of thousands of teachers leave the field, most of them before retirement age, every year. In Illinois, lawmakers recently passed several measures to address that state's shortage. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines has our story.
To find out what the teacher shortage looks like, I called Chuck Blyer, the superintendent of one district in rural southern Illinois. Blyer's about to post a job for a teaching position, and he's doubtful they'll be able to find someone.
It'll be very difficult.
Nearly a third of rural districts in the state have a serious problem with teacher shortages, according to a survey last year from the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools. Some 70% of urban districts reported having a minor to serious problem. The vast majority of superintendents surveyed, particularly those from rural and suburban districts, say significantly fewer qualified candidates are applying for teaching jobs compared to 5 years ago. I asked Blyer how the teacher shortage affects students in his district.
Well, I mean, I'm just being honest with you. The person that we're going to lose, we would have never hired. That's how bad the pool is right now. We're losing her, and she's terrible. It's that bad.
More than 2,000 teaching, administrative, and support staff positions went unfilled at schools across Illinois during the recent school year. Stacy Teft is concerned about the effects of that shortage. She teaches high school in the small Illinois city of Murfreesboro, and she says the lack of qualified teachers in classrooms robs kids of a quality education.
That's scary because this is our next generation. This is the future of the state, the country.
Illinois lawmakers passed legislation this spring to address the shortage, including making it easier for people to work as substitute teachers. The bill will also provide reciprocity for teachers licensed outside of Illinois. And another measure mandates minimum teacher salaries of $40,000 by 2022. Superintendent Chuck Blyer doesn't believe these measures are going to help.
No, that's a Band-Aid.
Republican State Representative Tom Bennett co-sponsored legislation aimed at addressing the problem, but he acknowledges it's not enough.
It's not going to be the silver bullet. We don't have any of those.
Bennett says the teacher shortage is a complex problem. Still, he's hopeful the state will turn the shortage around. And what will it take to do that? Chris Rogge from the University of Illinois' Council on Teacher Education says we already know what to do.
Compensation, preparation, induction and mentoring, and teaching conditions. All of these things help attract people in to teaching, and they help retain people once they're there.
And most of that can be boiled down to resources, Rogge says. That includes more money for teacher salaries, classroom materials, grants, and scholarships for students interested in the field. But the shortage legislation passed this spring doesn't provide extra funding for schools. Rogge says the measures are a short-term fix, not a long-term solution. Superintendent Chuck Blyer says it's not just about money. It's also about respect. He says educators feel less respected now than in previous decades.
We're blamed for everything that's wrong, and we're never given any credit for anything that's right. It's hard to get people to want to go into a field where you're never really respected by the country itself.
A lack of resources combined with the lack of respect for teachers drives many people out of the classroom. And Stacy Teft, the Murfreesboro teacher, warns that the people hurt most by this shortage are the students.
It's always about the kids, and they deserve the best, and they deserve the best future they can have. And right now, I'm not sure they're getting that. Just because you do not have the best people going into the education field because it's not enticing at the moment.
Teff says people working in education and those who left it understand the risks of not addressing the shortage. It's getting everyone else to share their sense of urgency that's frustrating. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
The midterm elections are about 3.5 months away, and we're going to look now at a couple of congressional races, starting with one in Massachusetts that may give us a glimpse of tensions within the Democratic Party. In the state's 7th congressional district, incumbent Congressman Michael Capuano, a member of the establishment, is facing a primary challenge in September from Boston City Councilor-at-Large Ayanna Pressley. Anthony Brooks from member station WBUR reports.
This race represents a generational split, among other things. Capuano is 66, first elected to Congress 20 years ago. Pressley is 44, first elected to the Boston City Council 8 years ago. The first woman of color to serve on that body in its 108-year history. Now she's hoping for a bigger stage.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here.
On a recent morning, Pressley spoke to a couple of dozen people at a cafe in Boston's Chinatown neighborhood. The 7th Congressional District, once represented by John F. Kennedy and then Tip O'Neill, includes most of Boston, and it's the state's most diverse district.
It is also the most unequal, and that's why I'm running, because I want to do something about it.
Pressley is the daughter of a single mother and a mostly absent father who was in and out of prison. She was also a victim of sexual abuse and says all of these experiences give her a new lens to represent what is now the state's only majority-minority congressional district.
I share my story because it isn't one I have the monopoly on. But what we see happening in Washington right now is a lack of empathy on steroids. So I do believe the confluence of my experiences uniquely equip me to represent the needs of this entire district.
Pressley's message appeals to people like Suzanne Lee, a community organizer and founder of the Chinese Progressive Association.
As a woman of color, you bring those experiences that you can't even explain to other people. But when you're at the table to discuss what issue we should be paying attention to and what impact that decision is going to have. So we need that in Congress.
And I am proud to stand with Mike Capuano, and it's time that we have his back because he's always had our back.
Mike Capuano recently brought his reelection campaign to Boston's South End, where the Bay State Stonewall Democrats, an LGBT advocacy group, endorsed him. Capuano casts himself as an advocate of progressive causes, ready to take on the Trump agenda.
I actually like a good fight, which is probably a bad thing. And right now we need good fighters, and I think I'm pretty good at it.
Capuano has the advantage of incumbency and the support of the state's Democratic establishment. The Congressional Black Caucus, including the civil rights icon John Lewis, have endorsed him. Here's Jeremy Comeau, co-chair of the Bay State Stonewall Democrats.
After Orlando, the Orlando shooting, he was on the floor, sat on the floor of Congress to say, no more. We want gun regulations now. Mike hasn't really been silent about anything. He's been a progressive leader.
Capuano argues that if Democrats retake the House in November, his seniority will give him significant clout. And he rejects Presley's argument that she can better represent this increasingly diverse district.
I was raised in this district as well. And in this particular race, I don't think anybody can match my long-term record. You just heard it here that we've fought for all kinds of issues that are important to the people in the gay community. I was doing it before it was popular.
This race isn't about policy differences. Capuano and Presley are both progressive Democrats who would agree on most, if not all, major issues. But the Reverend Jeffrey Brown, who's backing Presley, says this contest has huge significance.
I think this is absolutely about the soul of the Democratic Party.
Brown is a pastor at the 12th Baptist Church in Boston and a longtime community activist. He argues the economic disparities that are so evident in the district cry out for the change in perspective and priorities that Presley represents.
We see a party that hasn't changed, that needs to find fresh ideas. They have to be asking themselves, what are we doing that's not touching the constituencies that we hope to touch? And how can we change in order to address that? Because that's the only way to become strong.
The last thing liberals need at this point is to have fights that are generated by personality and ego with zero issues.
This is Barney Frank, the former Massachusetts congressman who supports Capuano and who calls Presley's challenge bad for Democrats.
So that money and energy that should be spent for us trying to take back the Congress is spent on internal fights.
But Ayanna Presley pushes back and says this is a fight that Democrats need.
You know, we are losing youth and women and people of color from the Democratic Party specifically. Now, why is that? Usually at the end of a family fight, they are better and they are stronger for it. And I would like to think the same will be true here.
The challenge from Presley is pretty much the first time Capuano has had to work hard to defend his seat since he was elected 20 years ago. It also means for the first time in a while, voters in Massachusetts' 7th Congressional District have a choice. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
So that's Massachusetts. How about Georgia now, where voters go to the polls tomorrow in an election that's gotten the attention of the White House? Vice President Mike Pence was in Macon, Georgia over the weekend to support Brian Kemp for governor.
Brian Kemp is tough on crime. He'll always fight to keep dangerous criminals off the street. And Brian Kemp will always fight to make sure that law-abiding citizens have the right to keep and bear arms as guaranteed in the Constitution of the United States.
President Trump has also tweeted his endorsement of Kemp. Let's take a look now at some of the key races in that Georgia primary with Bradley George of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Bradley.
Hey, Peter.
The Republican primary for governor, we've got Brian Kemp running against Casey Cagle. But let's start with Kemp. I mean, he was this guy who was able to get the president's endorsement. How did he do that?
We're not quite sure how he got the president's endorsement because it took everyone by surprise, even Kemp himself. Now, we know that Trump likes winning and winners, and certainly in the runoff. For the GOP nomination, the momentum really has been on Kemp's side. So maybe that's what caught the president's attention here.
Okay, and what about Casey Cagle? Because he had also been trying to align himself with President Trump just a few weeks before the president's endorsement of Kemp. Cagle released this ad.
Trump gets things done. Conservative Casey Cagle's like President Trump. He and Governor Deal get results. Record job growth, historic tax cuts, outlawed sanctuary cities. Brian Kemp, he just mucks things up. Stiffed farmers.
Okay, I assume
millions.
Each candidate here trying to appeal to Trump's conservative base in Georgia, but how does Cagle stack up in this race?
Well, there's not a whole lot of difference between Cagle and Kemp in terms of their policy positions. They're both Republicans in a generally Republican state. The difference with Casey Cagle is that he's been in state government for a long time. He's been the lieutenant governor. And the current Republican governor who can't run for re-election, Nathan Deal, he came out and endorsed Cagle. And Cagle has been trying to tie himself to Deal and some of his policy initiatives and some of the successes that he's had.
Now, this is interesting. The winner of tomorrow's primary will go up against a historic candidate on the Democratic side, Stacey Abrams, as the first black woman to be nominated for the governor of Georgia. So between those two Republican opponents, do you get a sense of which candidate she would prefer?
I think Stacey Abrams knows that if it's Cagle or it's Kemp, that there's going to be a full court press from that campaign, whoever comes out the winner, and also from national Republicans to defend this seat. So I think she that's true regardless of who wins this election tomorrow. So I think that it doesn't really matter for her, because it's for her it's the same thing. She's running against the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is going to bring their resources to bear in this race.
It'll be tough for her either way.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about another important race in this primary. The House seat in the 6th district, that's in the North Atlanta suburbs. Tell us about the two Democrats there.
There are two Democrats. The first is Lucy McBath. She is the mother of Jordan Davis, who is this teenager who was killed in Jacksonville, Florida in 2012 for playing loud music. Since then, she's been outspoken on gun control issues. She's actually a spokeswoman for the group Every Town for Gun Safety. The other Democrat is Kevin Abel. He's lived in the district for a long time. He runs a technology consulting business. He emigrated from South Africa when he was 14 years old with his family. And he talks a lot about his ties to the district in this race.
The district is one we've been talking about for a while now. Last year, there was that special election to fill Tom Price's old seat before he briefly served as Health and Human Services Secretary, left Congress to do that. It was the most expensive House race in history. And Democrats thought that John Ossoff would flip that seat, but of course he came up short. So do either of these Democrats in this race stand a better chance to take the seat?
Well, I think both of them have learned lessons from the Ossoff campaign. Number one is not to nationalize this race. It was just Peter, I can't emphasize how much the media attention this race generated both here and in the rest of the country. So both candidates are trying to talk more about local issues and connect with voters that way rather than try to make it a referendum on national issues or President Trump.
And just quickly, weigh in on this other story that is fascinating in Georgia right now.
Oh,
Republican
boy.
State Senator Jason Spencer, a victim, I guess you might say, some people might disagree with that, of Sacha Baron Cohen, the satirist, on his new Showtime show.
Yeah, we can't play the clips on the radio, but listeners can go seek them out on social media. They're pretty crazy. And Jason Spencer is facing calls to resign. He said he's not. He says he regrets some of the statements that he made in that video, but he's staying put for now.
He used the N-word for one. He actually pulled his pants down at one point in the interview as well. So that's causing some problems for him in Georgia. Bradley George of Georgia Public Broadcasting, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The duck boat at the center of that tragedy that left 17 people dead at Table Rock Lake in Missouri has been brought to the surface. 31 people were on the boat when it sank 80 feet to the bottom of the lake. But it's not the first time safety concerns have been raised. Nearly 20 years ago, the National Transportation Safety Board sounded the alarm after 13 people died when a duck boat sank in just 7 minutes in Arkansas. And last year, Stephen Paul sounded his own alarm. He's the owner of Test Drive Technologies Inspection Services in St. Louis. In 2017, he wrote a report for Ripley Entertainment, the company whose boat sank last week. Stephen, welcome to Here and Now. And you inspected boats for the company. What did you tell them?
I warned them that the ducks would not pass federal or Missouri Department of Transportation standards. The first thing that raised a red flag with me was that the exhaust was forward of the passenger compartment, which is a big no-no with commercial vehicles. The exhaust always has to come out behind the passengers.
Why does that matter?
Well, while you're going down the road, if you have exhaust coming out in front of the vehicle, the passengers are going to be exposed to carbon monoxide poisoning. A couple of other small items that I noticed was that the ducks did not have a rear bumper, which Department of Transportation standards require a rear bumper for collision avoidance. And then there was also a height requirement violation with the marker lights along the sides.
I understand you also said that in the case of severe or inclement weather, which of course there was last week, that those boat engines could fail.
That is correct. With the exhaust coming out the front, and dipping below the water line, water could get up into that exhaust and then end up cutting that engine off. And some of those ducts, they're housed in what's called a C-box, which is a special airtight box that has the pump and stuff in it. But nonetheless, if the engine's not running, then the duct's not going to be able to pump out its own water.
So was it your opinion that these boats owned by this company were not safe?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that the regulating bodies have not come together to regulate these amphibious vehicles. Department of Transportation doesn't want to have anything to do with them, and the U.S. Coast Guard only knows water, so they don't know how to regulate it on the land. Unfortunately, I think if both regulating bodies had come together and developed some sort of standard for amphibious vehicles specifically and decided who was going to do the inspection on them, these boats would either have been designed differently or not in operation.
I want to play some tape from a survivor of last week's crash, Tia Coleman. 9 members of her family died in this incident, and she said over the weekend that the captain told them they did not have to wear their life vests, even though they were on the boat.
Nobody grabbed them because we listened to the captain as he told us to stay seated. However, in doing that, when it was time to grab them, it was too late.
When you hear that, what do you think? I mean, would life jackets have made a difference?
I can see that if you had a life jacket on in that craft, that with the canopy and the sides down on it, you're going to be trapped. You're not going to have any way to exit. And the only way to get out was the back of that craft because the windows were still down.
Stephen Paul, owner of Test Drive Technologies Inspection Services in St. Louis. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
This week, trade representatives from the U.S., Canada, and Mexico resume their renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. President Trump launched a review of the 24-year-old trade deal last August, but talks stalled amid threats of new U.S. tariffs and Mexico's presidential election. The new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, takes office in December. Guillermo Malpica Soto is the head of Mexico's trade and NAFTA office. He joins us from Washington. Guillermo, these talks have been going on for almost a year. What's the status of the negotiations right now?
Well, so far we have been negotiating for 7 rounds. We had a couple of months after the 7th round of continuous negotiations, as we call them, and some important meetings at the ministerial level. And after mid-May, we entered into a pause in the negotiation, not formal pause, but we were basically with a lower level of intensity in the negotiations, and now we're trying to resume them shortly.
Do you feel like they're going well?
I think in general terms, we have been able to engage in a constructive discussion in most of the chapters, most of the topics. So far, we have closed 9 chapters and 6 sectoral annexes, and I think that's a good result. We still have a long way to go to conclude. We have some important topics that we need to solve before having a clear idea on how much time we will require to conclude the negotiation, where we are in the best intention to the 3 parties, I guess, to move faster now that we have resumed, or that we are intending to resume negotiations.
And what are those topics? What are the sticking points right now?
Well, we had a number of new proposals from the U.S. around round 4. And some of them are problematic for Mexico and for Canada. Perhaps one of the most important ones is the one related to what has been called the Sunset Clause. This is a provision in which the U.S. is proposing to terminate the agreement every 5 years. That is a proposal that directly is in conflict with our objectives of negotiation, which is precisely, one of them is precisely to provide greater certainty to the users of the agreement. So terminating an agreement basically does not provide any certainty for those long-term businesses or investments in the region.
And the U.S. is pushing for that. They want to have a sunset clause.
They have said repeatedly that that for them it's important to have that clause. And of course, we have been stating our position and trying to come up with alternatives to that.
Would one alternative just be a longer sunset, like 10 years or something like that?
I don't think so, because, I mean, we will start tackling less investments, but the problem, the systemic problem would remain. I mean, basically, agreements are negotiated and signed for a longer term, I mean, forever, basically, mm-hmm. unless a party decides to walk out. So the alternative we're proposing is not to have a termination of the agreement, but to have some clause of review of the agreement every 5 years, and also the opportunity to recommend improvements to the provisions or to the for the decision makers to take those into consideration.
Well, of course, one of the concerns all along since the beginning of these negotiations is that the U.S. would potentially pull out of NAFTA. President Trump has talked about that. He's been very outspoken in his criticism of the agreement. Let's listen to him talking in May.
NAFTA is very difficult. Mexico has been very difficult to deal with. Canada has been very difficult to deal with. They have been taking advantage of the United States for a long time. I am not happy with their requests, but I will tell you, in the end, we win. We will win, and we'll win big.
First of all, what do you think when you hear that?
Well, I think we have to be to have a fact-based analysis of what has been NAFTA for the three countries during these years. I think it is very clear if you see numbers that the exports trade in general terms for the region have grown, that we have more jobs, that we have better paid jobs, at least in the case of Mexico, that we have had a massive flow of investment. So there are numbers out there that tell a different story. We're basically talking about improving the provisions in the agreement and making a better agreement. We of course, are prepared for the different scenarios, but our main objective is to have a NAFTA plus result in this negotiation.
And when you hear President Trump say Mexico has been very difficult to deal with, that they're taking advantage of the United States, how do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know if that is a compliment or a criticism. I would say that Mexico has a very clear idea of what we want to achieve with this negotiation. When we started, we conducted consultations, public consultations, and also made a very deep analysis of what we wanted for this modernization exercise. We didn't want it in the first place. I mean, we were not proposing to renegotiate NAFTA, but once we were in that position, we took advantage of it, and we have four very clear objectives for the negotiation: to modernize the agreement, to provide greater certainty, to approach this exercise from a regional perspective, and of course to make an agreement that is more inclusive.
Now, you mentioned that NAFTA has been good for Mexico in terms of wage growth. When you look at the average wage in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, it's a little more than $2 an hour right now. In the United States, it's about $22 an hour. So maybe NAFTA has brought up the wages in Mexico. I wonder, though, if you think it's ever going to be fair to have a free trade agreement with a country where the labor is so much cheaper, because why would anybody want to build a factory in the United States when they could build it in Mexico and have the same advantage when it comes to selling the goods?
Well, I don't know if it's fair or not. It would depend on other considerations. What I would say is that the decision of a company to establish in one particular country depends on a number of factors, not only wage. Wages have been increased in Mexico as a result of NAFTA. Actually, wages of workers in sectors which are very much into exports are significantly higher than wages which are not in the export sector. And I think that as the wage difference exists in this among the three countries, there are also other factors that determine the decision of a company to establish that may be in favor of one country or the other. I mean, it's just talking about the wage differentiation. I think it's not the complete story of the factors to assess what is determining the competitiveness of each one of the countries.
Is there any area of NAFTA that you feel right now that the U.S. is getting a better deal than Mexico?
It's difficult to make an assessment at this point because we are still under negotiation. I would say that once we have a result, once we have an agreement, the three countries, Mexico, the U.S. and Canada, will have to have the internal task to build on the results and try to sell those results to their own constituents. I mean, as in any negotiation, you have to give some and take some in exchange, and that at the end of the game, you have to be able to build a success story. A negotiation is successful when all the parties perceive that they have gained something in as a balance of the negotiation.
So Mexico just elected this new president, the leftist Andrés Manuel López Obrador. I think back to when President Trump was elected in this country, and he immediately did the opposite of what his predecessor wanted to do on trade when it comes to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and he pulled out of that deal. Do you think that there will be a change in NAFTA policy with López Obrador?
As for trade policy, I mean, we still need to see that he has to take his position on December the 1st. But what he has been saying during the campaign is not that. I mean, he has been supportive in general terms of what the trade policy has been for Mexico, and he has been supportive of the exercise of modernization of NAFTA. And he has said that actually that the current negotiating team has been doing things in the right manner. They would add elements to the negotiation, but in general terms, they have not expressed concerns or criticism to the work of the negotiation.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this, especially in the context of what we just heard from President Trump. He's really going after both Mexico and Canada. You seem to be very diplomatic on this one.
Well, I mean, we're here to work, and we are. Our task is to find the common elements in the negotiation and how to build on a better result for the three of us. We approach this negotiation under a regional perspective. We don't believe that a good result is only good for Mexico. We believe that a good result is good for the three countries.
That's Guillermo Malpica Soto, who is the head of the Trade and NAFTA Office in Mexico's Ministry of Economy, joining us from Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Most TV game shows are about winning money and prizes. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Wheel of Fortune? Jeopardy? But listen to this clip from a new game show.
Hey, I'm Jay. I went to St. John's River State College, studied liberal arts, and I have $20,462 in student loan debt.
All right, liberal arts major, very well.
$20,462 in student loan debt. That is from Paid Off on the comedy channel True TV. Contestants compete by answering trivia questions. Winners get to have their college debt paid off. Derek Thompson has been thinking about this. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And where do we start with this? What does this say about America that this is our game show in 2018?
Well, I think it says a lot about where we are as a country, sadly. I mean, here you have an entertainment company that is essentially creating a game show to subsidize college education in America. I mean, that is what government should do. That is what government does all over the world, is that it's the national government that helps young people pay for their education. And here in the U.S., you have the Tribune Broadcasting Company essentially offering the equivalent of Pell Grants to college graduates. And, it's sad to think that we live in a world where middle and lower class college graduates have to apply to a television program in order to get out of debt.
That's one way of doing it, I guess. Now, listen to this recent episode. This is a woman named Madeline who won, but she didn't get enough questions right in the final rapid-fire round to get all of her $41,000 in debt paid off. Let's listen.
What's salty sea between Israel and... Oh! So close! We had 7 correct right on the door. But come here. Listen. 7 correct.
Okay.
That means we're paying off 50% of your debt.
Oh, my God.
Plus what you won in the first couple rounds. That brings you up to $24,211.
I hope it helps take off some of the pressure. You connect this to what's happening in the real world, that people are being punished with lower debt burdens.
Yeah. So there are two ways I think that this show implicitly mirrors what's happening in the real world. First, at a really simple level, the labor market is a competition between often college graduates for money. And this is a game show that is a competition between indebted college graduates for money. But second, at a more granular level, The show implicitly punishes people with lower debt burdens. In the last round, the winner gets a check equal to their total debt. So that means a contestant fresh out of law school with $40,000 in debt can earn 10 times more from the show than a community college grad with $4,000 in debt. And you know, that, too, is a simulation of the labor market. You know, overall, not in every case, but overall, this is counterintuitive, but students with higher debt burdens are actually less likely to default on their loans. That's often because they went to grad school, they went to law school, medical school. And so I pointed this out to the show creators. I said, you know, it's kind of ironic that you helped to mirror this part of the labor market as well. I'm not trying to overly criticize the show. It's great they're helping people overturn their or pay off their debt. But this is, in fact, a simulation of the normal labor market.
They're also raising this important issue about student debt in this country. How much is there at this point?
So there's about $1.4 to $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt, and that's more than doubled in the past decade. I think it's really important to state here that this is a uniquely American problem. This is American exceptionalism. In several European countries, you look at Germany, Norway, Finland, public institutions offer free tuition. In Canada and Japan, which don't necessarily offer the same kind of free tuition, still the average cost of public college university is 50% less than in the U.S. So the U.S. is one of the richest countries in the world in terms of per capita GDP. It has some of the best colleges in the world. But a college education here, a little bit like healthcare, is an expensive ticket that you have to punch to enter the labor market.
I remember interviewing the governor of California, Jerry Brown, years ago and asked him if he thought, and he's a big believer in public education. California, they've got some of the best state schools. Whether he thought that it would ever be possible again to make it free for the people of California to go to those schools. And he didn't think that that was going to be a possibility. Derek, I wonder why this has not become more of a political issue. It was part of Bernie Sanders' campaign, but it really wasn't in the general election last time a major issue.
That's a great point. This is a really good question. So three theories that come to mind are, number one, the Trump eclipse. That Donald Trump is just such a big news story that he sort of blots out the sun a bit, and we forget about things that we talked about 2-3 years ago. Second, Democrats aren't in power, and Republicans at the federal level just haven't made the high cost of college a priority. And even at the local level, in fact, a lot of Republican state governments have cut education spending, and that has the effect of increasing tuition. And then three, you know, a glimmer of good news to end the segment is the steady recovery. You know, worker wages are growing, even if not quickly, and maybe that's washed away a bit of the urgency around student debt.
And you hear that sound in the background, Derek, which means our time is up and we don't even have a Plinko game for you. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you so much.